From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. And this week, another important topic that affects us in the U.S. as well as in Kentucky. Our question of the week, why do we care about Ukraine? Major issues, some things going on over there that, of course, are of curiosity for us. Many people, our listeners who are world citizens, are paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine and in other situations around the world. And we'd like to focus on this area of the world and learn more about the history, about the politics, and perhaps even the people of that area. And we have with us in the studio today three guests. First up, we have Dr. Ken Slepian, professor of history at Transylvania University. His primary areas of research include Soviet and Russian history, of which he's written extensively, modern European history, and the Holocaust. His most recent publication, The Soviet Union, 1939 to 2000, A History in Documents. Dr. Slepian, has that been released yet?
No, still. In production.
And date of publication coming?
Hopefully 2015, possibly 2016.
Okay, something to look forward to. Dr. Slepian, thank you for being with us. With us also is Natasha Williams, Artistic Managing Co-Director of Balagula Theater in Lexington, which stages its productions in Natasha's Bistro and Bar, which Natasha opened with her husband after she left the USSR. Natasha is a native of Moscow and has spent some time, extensive amount of time in Ukraine.
Yeah, most of my life in the Soviet Union was in Kiev.
Okay, excellent. We're going to catch up with Natasha as we get into the program here as well. And Ambassador Carrie Cavanaugh is director of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce, located at the University of Kentucky. Prior to this, Ambassador Cavanaugh served as a foreign service officer with the U.S. Department of State, with assignments in the State Department, the Pentagon, Moscow, Tbilisi, Rome, Bern, and Berlin. He joined the Patterson School in 2006. And Ambassador Cavanaugh, I understand you were involved in attempting to resolve conflicts in the former Soviet Union.
I was, sadly, and it shows how difficult the job that was, that these conflicts remain.
We will come back to you in just a few minutes after we talk first with Professor Slepian about the history of and recent history. As we prior to the show, I know you told me that we could go back a long, long way to talk about the roots of the conflict between the folks of Ukraine and Russia. Of course, as far as history is concerned, the Soviet Union was really a short blip on the screen. But as best you can you fill us in on why the conflict right now in Ukraine versus Russia?
Okay, well, I think the first thing to keep in mind is the name Ukraine itself can be loosely translated as on the border. And Ukraine is very much a borderland region, which means it's come under the influence and been influenced and shaped by numerous cultures, Russian, Polish, Lithuanian, Mongol as far back, Austrian. So Ukraine really is a complicated mixture of various cultural influences. I threatened earlier that we could go back as far as 862 with the founding of the Russian state, because both Kiev and Moscow share a common lineage back to that time. But I won't do that. I think the first thing to keep in mind is that the formal linkage of Russia to Ukraine, at least eastern Ukraine anyway, occurred as far back as the 17th century. But by the 18th century, you had a split in as far as Ukraine was concerned. That is, a good chunk of it, the eastern part of Ukraine, was linked as part of the Russian Empire, while the western part, especially after the Kingdom of Poland, which was one of the largest kingdoms in 18th century Europe, was dismembered by the Prussians, the Austrians, and the Russians, western Ukraine came under Austrian influence. And so you had Ukraine bifurcated between the Russian Empire on the one hand and the Habsburg Empire on the other, and the two developed in very different directions. So you have an Eastern Ukrainian history and an Eastern Ukraine dominated by Russia, with a lot of Russian speakers, which is one of the things that we see today. And you have a Western Ukraine, which came under a very different set of influences, a very different kind of cultural and intellectual background. Only after the Russian Revolution in 1917 do you start to see the formation of Ukraine as we understand it geographically today. And on the eve, or actually at the very beginning of the Second World War, Western Ukraine had become a part of Poland. In 1939, 1940, the Soviet Union, as part of the agreement with Nazi Germany, annexed that. And this is where you now have the borders of today's modern Ukraine. But again, it's Ukraine which brought together a Western Ukraine, which came under a very different kind of development, where Ukrainians very often spoke Ukrainian, and an Eastern Ukraine, which was predominated by Russian speakers. Now, these Russian speakers didn't necessarily identify themselves as either Russian or Ukrainian, but they spoke Russian. And so you have that kind of language differential that takes place today.
Who are the current, antagonists or the folks who are in conflict in this current situation, as we focus on the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner? Is it a fairly simple matter of folks who wish to align with Russia and those who do not?
I wish it was simple. That would make it easier to deal with, but it's not. Very often we hear that the split in Ukraine today is between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers, and I don't think that's actually the case.
That's just a matter of media attempts to simplify?
Well, I mean, there's some basis of truth to it, but what you have, it's also partially generational. So that is, younger people, whether they speak Ukrainian or Russian, tend to identify as Ukrainian. Older people who grew up in the context of the Soviet Union might, as Russian speakers, might tend to identify themselves as Russian. But it's not a clear easy mix. But you have basically what you have is a situation where you have certainly folks in the western and central part of the country strongly identifying as Ukrainian. And then there is a mix, and it's perhaps not quite certain, but some section of the population, which as Russian speakers identify more closely with Russia than they do with Ukraine. But I don't think we have a very good idea what the actual proportion of people is on that.
What is your opinion of who did the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner?
My opinion, and this is based on opinion, which itself is based on some evidence, but of course we don't really know. My guess would be that it was the separatists who did it, but I don't think they did it intentionally. It certainly would not be in their interest to do so. My understanding is that they probably saw this blip on the radar screen, and for the weapon that they were using, that doesn't tell them very much about the details of it, and they shot at it. They had brought down a Ukrainian transport plane before, and they probably thought that they were shooting at the same thing. And in fact, the tweets and other social media claimed that that's in fact what they had done. And then when they discovered that it was an airliner that went down, they quickly changed that. So that would be my guess, but I certainly don't know that.
What is the goal of the separatists?
I think their goal, well, it depends on who you're talking about, because of course it's not just simply the separatists, but there's strong connections to Moscow. I think it depends on which separatists you talk about. Separatists who are people who claim to be separatists but might possibly be agents of the Russian state, my guess would seek either some kind of union with Russia or perhaps just simply want to destabilize the region. There may be other separatists who truly want to have a union with Russia or want to have an independent state. But I suspect that for those people who truly are independent actors who want to see a break off from Ukraine, that their goal would be to unite with Russia. But again, there are multiple actors here with multiple perspectives and different allegiances.
What's the background on the resignation of the democratically elected president last year and that whole turnover in terms of rule over Ukraine?
Well, that president, Yanukovych, had been elected democratically by the Ukrainian population. But again, it was part reflecting Yanukovych was born a Russian speaker. He learned to speak Ukrainian, but apparently not very well. People joked about that. He was originally going to sign a trade deal with the European Union, but came under extreme pressure from Putin not to sign that deal. And there are reasons for why Putin didn't want it, didn't want that to happen, to make sure that Ukraine predominantly did not align itself with the West. Yanukovych backed off on a deal he said that he was going to sign, and this led then to the protests in Kiev. The protests continued for some months. Nothing seemed to be going on, and then they escalated, and they escalated particularly when Ukrainian security police fired on the protesters. And once that happened, the whole situation became radicalized, and Yanukovych was essentially forced out of office.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Our topic for today's program, why should we, why do we care about Ukraine? And let me pose this to you in the really a minute we have before a station break, Dr. Ken Slepian. Why does the U.S. care about what's going on over there?
Well, a few reasons. One, we could see what happens when these conflicts escalate. We had an airliner that was shot down with people who had nothing to do with the Ukrainian crisis. That could have happened to any of us. Second, I think we have issues with wanting to make sure that Europe remains as stable as possible. What's taking place here is extraordinarily destabilizing, not just for Ukraine, but for the entire region. And then third, there are matters of principle. Do sovereign states have a right to remain sovereign without outside interference? And clearly, well, clearly, I think that we have an issue when a state like Russia is trying to make this kind of influence.
I mean, I assume there is a lot of discussion. I know there's a lot of discussion about the potential for U.S. involvement in that area. Is there a possibility, or what would be the possibility of American military involvement in some fashion? And what effect could that even have?
I would hope that there would not be any kind of overt American military involvement. It's kind of hard to imagine that. But in the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the First World War, one can never rule out such accidents. I would think the involvement will be political, diplomatic, and economic.
And that's underway? You think that?
Oh, yes, it's already underway.
This is Eastern Standard. We're going to invite our listeners to be part of the program at some point. Please feel free to send in an email now with your questions, your comments, personal stories if you have experience of Ukraine or Russia. Write to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. You can send us a direct tweet after you follow us at WEKU EST, post on the WEKU Facebook page. Or call, but it'll be a while before we actually put any callers on the air. You're welcome to call in now, 800-621-8890. We return to our topic, why do we care about Ukraine? And our guests, we will get to Ambassador Kavanaugh and Natasha Williams, as well as Professor Ken Slepian on this week's Eastern Standard on WEKU. Why should we care about Ukraine is our topic on this week's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen with our guest, Dr. Ken Slepian of Transylvania University, Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky, and Natasha Williams, very much associated with the arts community in the Lexington area, but a native of Moscow and of very much involved and spending much of her life in Ukraine. We'll learn more about Natasha's story in just a few moments. But Ambassador Kavanaugh, let's pick it up with you. We're talking about the fact that the U.S. has some interests in Ukraine and Russia, and you have extensive experience in the Soviet Union. Pick it up with what you think is important for us.
Well, I'd like to pick up first something Ken mentioned, and this is the 100th anniversary of World War I. And what we saw there was an issue that remains with us today, and it's a question of how do you deal with the dual principles of territorial integrity. Countries should be able to have borders and protect themselves, and self-determination. And no one expected in 1914 that a nationalist in Serbia would do something that would launch a major conflagration that brought the world up. And what we see is that same kind of issue. Where do you draw lines between then empires, now nations? Where do you draw lines between how do you properly attain the ability to seek self-determination? It has not been settled.
I mean, 100 years ago, it took a long time to get over there to Serbia or to Russia, and now we're interconnected electronically and by satellite.
No, so everything happens a lot quicker. It certainly puts a premium on more effective and careful decision-making. And I think what we see, and we heard some of the history already, is there's an issue here about Ukraine, but there's a broader issue here about Russia and its place in the world. And much of what we're seeing going on in some ways has little to do with Ukraine and much to do with Moscow, much to do with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. He has clearly not gotten over the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he talks about that as being the worst thing that ever happened in Russian history, that collapse where out of one country comes 15. And what we heard in part of Ken's discussion about Ukrainians was the fact that Ukrainians inside the Soviet Union sort of lived a regular life and they didn't have a lot of self-identification issues. And I was fortunate in being able to go to Ukraine right after the country broke up, and I actually went to Donetsk as well. And when you would talk to Russian speakers in Ukraine, they were very happy to be in Ukraine. In fact, their thought was they would have a better chance at economic prosperity and a greater degree of freedom in this new republic than they would have had the Soviet Union continued. So it isn't a case of if you speak Russian and live in Ukraine, you want an independent country or you want to be part of Russia. And in fact, Russia's economic indicators, its health indicators would suggest the exact opposite. If you're Ukrainian, you become a Russian, your life expectancy just dropped about a dozen years. Your potential to earn income just dropped about 25% to 30%. This isn't a great solution. And we've already seen this with the annexation of Crimea. These people are not living better. So the problem becomes, how do they live happily in Ukraine? And how do you make sure that someone can't claim they're being mistreated and use that as a pretense to get involved politically or militarily? And what we see here now is, whether right or wrong, Russia has gotten involved politically and militarily in an effort that really undermines the Ukrainian state.
Those of us who were aware of what was going on in the world during the Reagan administration saw the president, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, the separation between East and West Berlin, the separation that was a result of the Soviet Union and the demise of the Soviet Union. We Americans, I believe, rejoiced in general about the demise of the Soviet Union. Our major enemy in the world, a major opponent, was no longer the powerful enemy that it was. And they went through a number of presidents and a number of years, a couple of decades, did we not, where we felt we were kind of forging a friendship with Russia. Things were getting better. The Cold War had warmed up tremendously. And so with Mr. Putin, all of that is in the process of reversing.
It is. And for a period in there, actually, I think people were quite optimistic that we would forge a very solid relationship with the new Russia. And we directed a lot of financial assistance toward both Russia and the other new independent states in the hopes that a prosperous, stable Europe is to the benefit of everyone.
How and why did Putin become president?
In part over concerns in Russia that the new Russia wasn't really working out as well as people had hoped. And part of that is severe economic difficulties that we see not only in Russia, but all around the world. And a number of people did not do very well in the new Russia. The new Russia favored a very thin entrepreneurial class. A lot of the state-owned industries were very quickly sold off and gobbled up by a very small handful of oligarchs in the end. So all of a sudden, a place that had been generally equal, but not perfectly so, had a huge wealthy class and a lot of people who had a bleak life, but one that was stable, no longer had that. So if you were a pensioner with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you lost your pension, you lost your apartment, state health care didn't look as good anymore, the factory you worked at probably stopped working. And what was there for you? You weren't going to become a taxi driver. You weren't going to start a dot-com business. So you started favoring more conservative parties.
Let's turn to someone who is a native of that area of the world. And Natasha Williams, again, folks in Lexington know you from your bistro and the Balagula Theater. But prior to that, as a Russian citizen and having been in Ukraine, what does all of this current situation mean to you? What brought you to the U.S., first of all?
Well, the personal story. I fell in love with an American, so came here.
But your experience in Russia and Ukraine, you're hearing Ambassador Kavanaugh. Does that sound accurate to you?
Very much so. Very much so. In the former Soviet Union, because I wasn't a Russian citizen, neither I was Russian or Ukrainian. In the former Soviet Union, we identified our nationality by the by what it says in your passport, by basically your lineage. So by nationality, in my passport, I would be Jewish. A lot of people in Ukraine, who lived in Ukraine or in Russia, did not identify themselves as Ukrainians or Russians because of the special connection to Ukrainian or Russian culture, but because they were formerly Russians or Ukrainians. And a lot of it was just statistical issue. It wasn't, you know, cultural orientation. Linguistically, and I'm a linguist by education, linguistically it's very fascinating what happened in Ukraine in a very short time, because linguistically this region's that we were talking about, the eastern and western Ukraine, spoke very different Ukrainian. And there was a standard Ukrainian that was taught in school. And that was a literary Ukrainian, which is very different or more Russified compared to the language that is spoken in the western areas, western parts, that has a lot of influence of Romanian and Polish languages. And that is more like a language that you hear Canadian Ukrainians speak. What happened with the reform of the language in a very, very short time, everything moved towards the Western, because, you know, the need to separate Russian and Ukrainian languages was so great that suddenly everything moved towards the Western version of the Ukrainian language. And the knowledge and that is the language that was taught, and this language was very quickly and artificially developed, because in the former Soviet Union, basically, it didn't make a lot of sense to write a paper, scientific paper, in Ukrainian. You would write it in Russian so that everybody in all the republics could read it, because that was the language of, you know, international communication. So a lot of, in this sense, in the sense of becoming more contemporary and more up-to-date, Ukrainian language was stagnating. So there was no linguistic base to support the language of engineering, of science, of medicine. So that was very quickly artificially developed and taught. Mm. And there was a period when, you know, when the new device, for example, would be prepared to be sold on the market, and if the instructions would be written in Russian, then with the help of the dictionary translated in Ukrainian, sent somewhere where somebody with the help of the same dictionary would translate it back to Russian to understand it. So in some way, okay, when your language and the majority of Eastern Ukrainians spoke Russian or Surzhik, which is the kind of in between Russian and Ukrainian language, they felt deprived, because suddenly their natural language in which they express themselves became second class.
So the language issue is very much at the core of the conflict.
Of course, well, it is one of the issues that defines how people feel. Mm. You know, just like media here, when we're talking about terrorists, right? We're called separatist terrorists. We immediately created the connotational meaning to how people feel about it.
As opposed to the noble American revolutionaries.
Right, they were not freedom fighters. And, you know, the same thing, you know, in Euromaidan, when there was rebellion against the legally elected president, right? We talked about these people as, you know, freedom fighters. As we never called them terrorists. We never called them, you know. So we were talking about revolution. We're talking about revolution. It's good. We're talking about terrorism. It's bad. So language is a powerful tool.
Natasha, you grew up as a little girl in the Soviet Union. I mean,
yes.
Born in Moscow. To what extent were you? How long were you in Moscow before you went to Ukraine?
I was 5 years old when we moved to Kiev. And
so really, your life was more focused on Ukraine than
yes,
on,
but
Russia.
But at the same time, because I had a lot of relatives in Moscow, we were more associated with Russian culture and Russian language than Ukrainian.
What was your life like? Were you a comfortable family? You're Jewish. Where do Jews fit into the culture and the society in Russia and Ukraine? Did Jews face the oppression that they may have faced in some portions of Europe, of course, during World War II.
Well, considering that when I was born in 1956, and that is right after, you know, Stalin's death, and very close to that time, the time when Stalin accused Jewish doctors of, you know, poisoning him. So there was a humongous wave. I mean, Russia and Ukraine were always anti-Semitic, but at that time there was a really strong wave of anti-Semitism in Russia and Ukraine. My mom, who tried to go to medical school, was told at the entrance exam to the medical school, was told outright that we don't need any more Jewish doctors and send back home. Hmm. Mom had a very hard time finding job in Ukraine when we moved there, because nobody would hire her until somebody who was Jewish, and, you know, just Jews just learned to help each other, mm-hmm. and survive this way. And there were quotas for everything. You know, for example, when the entrance exams to the universities, there was a quota. So many, like the percentage of Ukrainians, Russians, Jewish, that would be admitted were proportional to the percentage of the population, considering the Jews were the really little part of the population, but lived mostly in the urban areas and were seeking education. Well, so the competition between Jews to enter the university was much higher than the competition between Ukrainians and Russians.
You fell in love with an American and decided to emigrate to the United States. Did you in any way, shape, or form regret leaving Ukraine, or was that something you embraced wholeheartedly and gladly?
You know, believe it or not, it's a complicated question because,
It's home, right? It's your homeland?
Well, it actually is not, in a sense that when I go back and when I went back, it doesn't feel like home because it's a very different country now than it was, and it feels very different. It's very difficult, and it's very interesting that you both talked about the generational issues. It's a very generational issue. The generation, my generation, the population of my generation feels very much out of place in the Ukraine and in Russia because of how we were raised, how we were educated, and also because of this sense in the and this attitude in the younger people that it's somehow the fault of our generation that it didn't work out right. So in a way, the rebellion against the way of life we had is emotionally transferred onto the people of older generations. So we're fools. We didn't know how to do it right.
This is Eastern Standard, and Natasha Williams is one of our guests, the native of Russia and Ukraine. We have Ambassador Carrie Cavanaugh of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at UK, and Dr. Ken Slepian of Transylvania University. We are interested in your questions or your stories, 800-621-8890. Feel free to call in now, 800-621-8890. We'll be looking for some interesting stories or some questions that will help us move this topic forward as we learn more about why we should care about Ukraine. Dr. Ken Slepian, been a few minutes since we've spoken with you. You've heard some of Ambassador Kavanaugh's perspective and the story of Natasha Williams. How does that fit into your understanding of history of Ukraine and Russia?
Oh, very much so. What Ambassador Kavanaugh said about this being a story not only about Ukraine but also very much about Russia and what's going on there, I think is very important to understand at least motivation as to why this is taking place. And maybe one way for Americans to think about this is to try and understand this, particularly from the perspective of Russians. And again, to understand something does not mean to justify it, does not mean to say this is right and it's okay, but it is to at least understand the perspective. And if you go from the position of being a superpower up through the 1980s, and then almost suddenly find your country collapse, your borders reduced to what they had been back in the 17th century, parts of the country which had you had always thought as being just part of your own without distinction, now suddenly independent states, and finding that you are now being belittled by the victors of the Cold War, the Americans, which is how many Russians felt after the end of the Cold War. And then you see the introduction of capitalism and democracy, which in the 1990s meant for many Russians, as Ambassador Kavanaugh said, chaos and anarchy and a severe reduction of their standard of living. Somebody like Putin comes along who promises strength, restoration of Russian pride and dignity, and to say, look, we don't have to accept the status quo. We can return back to our former greatness. That's going to sound pretty good. And Putin was able to deliver, at least in part, because of the power of the petrostate. Russia relies extensively on natural gas and oil for its economic well-being. And in the 2000s, it did very well that way. Some people, especially in the major cities, saw increases in their standards of living. Putin looks pretty good by that stretch. And so we have to try and understand what's taking place in Russia. That's very much part of it.
We want to come back to that very specific approach, the issues of President Putin and Russia. We're talking why should we care about Ukraine on this week's Eastern Standard. 800-621-8890. Why do you care about Ukraine? Ask a question. Tell a story. 800-621-8890. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Why should we care about Ukraine? Our topic this week, 800-621-8890, the number you are welcome to call with your question or story or your comment about why you care about Ukraine. That's 800-621-8890. You can send us a tweet, follow us on Twitter at WEKUEST, and send us a direct tweet once you've done that. Post on our Facebook page. Send an email to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Again, that phone number, 800-621-8890. Our guests in the studio, Natasha Williams, a native of Russia and Ukraine, Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky, and Dr. Ken Slepian, professor of history at Transylvania University. And Dr. Slepian has a book that he's working on that will be out within a year or so, we are expecting, The Soviet Union, 1939 to 2000, A History in Documents. Dr. Slepian, talking about President Putin in Russia, how do the Russian people perceive him? Are they behind him and his efforts to perhaps restore the glory of the former Soviet Union?
Well, if you look at the opinion polls, I think Gallup did a poll very recently, it's plus 80% support Putin. Now, how accurate those polls are, you know, is hard to say. Russia is becoming increasingly an authoritarian state, but I think we have to assume that there's a strong basis of fact in that. Russians, for the time being, are very supportive of what he's doing, but he's playing a very, very dangerous game because he's been promoting the Russian separatists, internally. But if he does this, he's unleashing people on the far right who want to see Russia make a much more overt support, like perhaps, for example, send in troops. But at the same time, while Putin is riding that nationalist wave, he has to be very careful because he doesn't want to antagonize the West too much. And so he could be caught in a bit of a trap of his own making. That is, the more he pushes nationalism, the more he increases expectations, but he's got to rein that in. And then the other point, though, is that, as Ambassador Kavanaugh said, taking over Crimea doesn't necessarily mean people's lives improve. Crimea is going to be an extraordinary cost for the Russians to build the infrastructure. When they start seeing the drag on their economy that the sanctions and that Crimea take place, maybe not immediately, but over the course of time, this could impact his popularity.
Are we likely to see a resurgence of the Soviet Union, or is what Putin is attempting to bring about is an empowered and expanded Russia?
I don't think we'll see a resurgence in the Soviet Union at all. I think what you see are elements of how he would like it, and then tensions caused on the borders of Russia with some states that are more easy to interfere in than others. We saw this with the Georgian War during 2008, the Olympics. But the reality is life got a lot better in Central Asia. Life got a lot better in the Caucasus. The people of Armenia or Azerbaijan want to be independent. They had been independent once or twice before in their history, and they relish this, as did the people of Ukraine. The difficulty for them is it takes a while to develop a modern, stable, effective state. The biggest complaint in Ukraine was not about mistreatment of Russian or ethnic Russians living in Ukraine. It was corruption. It was, and when the president fled and they went into the presidential palace and found a pirate ship restaurant he had built for his own parties and everything gilded, and he had transferred ownership away from the government to himself. It's an enormously corrupt state. So their complaints are more the standard ones we would see in Greece or Western Europe, that they want jobs, they want efficient government, they want things properly run. So I think, no, there won't be a reconstitution of the Soviet Union. The challenge is, how do you deal with Putin's aim to minimize the expansion of Western institutions and Western attitudes into that space? And there's some legitimacy to his complaints, and there's legitimacy to what the West has done. He has been very concerned the desires to have NATO membership for countries like Georgia or Ukraine, and he's pointed that out. He's been very concerned that as those states get entwined in the European Union, that those economic structures block Russia out from areas that Russia had naturally been involved with. And I think his hope had been there would be a greater meeting of the minds on that. And for a variety of reasons, some even just bureaucratic, that hasn't happened. And one of the triggers for this crisis was the European Union pushing to have Ukraine sign agreements that included provisions that Ukraine would be involved in defense structures in Western Europe. And in Moscow, defense structures in Western Europe set off an alarm bell. That's NATO. NATO's anti-Russia, and we're not comfortable having Ukraine be militarily anti-Russia.
What is the status of arms in Russia and the former Soviet Union? Did they disarm? As far as nuclear weapons, for instance?
No, of course not. I mean, Ukraine did. There was an agreement reached with Ukraine and Kazakhstan that the nuclear weapons that were on their territory at the collapse of the Soviet Union returned to Russia. That was the case. And in fact, the United States and Russia have been involved in a very active dialogue to reduce nuclear weapons. In fact, that was one of President Obama's lead aims in becoming president. He gave a major speech in Prague on trying to move towards zero. And in fact, almost every year that Obama's been president, there's been a reduction in nuclear weapons, both in the United States and in Russia. So that process has been going on. But no, Russia's a major power. It has a seat on the permanent seat and a veto power on the UN Security Council. It has the second largest group of nuclear weapons on the planet behind the United States. It's a major power and will remain one. It doesn't need to reconstitute the Soviet Union to be that. And I think some of Putin's frustration, and we heard this from Ken's comments, is that, in fact, they were being given credit for that. It isn't a case of one side won the Cold War and the other lost and is gone. It's a case of there are serious powers in the world they need to be taken account of. And for the United States, it's important to keep in mind we need Russia for a lot of things. We can be mad at Russia. We can have problems with Russia. But in the difficulties we have with Iran, with their efforts to acquire nuclear energy and potentially nuclear weapons, Russia's a key partner in deterring that, in dealing with North Korea and their development of nuclear weapons. Russia's a key partner in dealing with that, in what's going to happen with Syria. We need Russia as part of that diplomatic effort. So this isn't a case that we're just going to be anti-Russia and split into two camps. We really have to find a way to bridge these differences.
This is Eastern Standard. You're welcome to get on board with a question or a story or a comment about why you care about Ukraine. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. Send an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. That number, 800-621-8890. Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh, Dr. Ken Slepian, and Natasha Williams with us in the studio. Natasha, you have a question or a concern about the role of petroleum and oil in this region?
Actually, it's a question, more the question of Ukraine being the part of the, well, Russia, of course, is the key to the question of Eurasian domination, which is very important to the United States because Eurasia is the major region that basically has 75% of the population, 60% of the natural resources, and, even in the long history of the view of American politicians such as Brzezinski, for example, the domination of Eurasia is the domination of the world. And so it is very important for the Ukraine to, Ukraine is basically, right now, is the element that allows to destabilize Russia and put Russia in the weaker position, which allows the United States to get political gain in also the situation with Ukraine, it weakens European position. And so United States is in a better position to express dominance. And there are things that we don't hear much about, and that is the deal that was signed by ousted President Yanukovych with ExxonMobil and Chevron, about it's a 50-year long deal that involves a lot of money that deals with gas shelling in the western Ukraine. And this whole goal that was expressed by an American ambassador and publicly in Ukraine of making Ukraine independent, from the point of view of energy resources, independent from Russia. And so there is this whole issue of gas from Russia that goes to Europe, Ukrainians being in control of the pipelines that are going, that are connecting Russia and Europe in terms of gas, and this whole opportunity, economic opportunity, for Ukrainian petroleum companies, for the American petroleum companies, to have this big deals in Ukraine. So what's the, how does that play into everything that we were talking about?
Well, I think it highlights the complexity of this region and the problems you face in trying to deal with it. We see from the cultural side, from the political side, from the economic side. And some of those things can't be changed. You can't change geography. For Russia gas to get to Western Europe, by and large, yes, it'll cross Ukraine or Belarus. There's no other route out for it to go aside from that. So there's a challenge there. When we talk about this being a border region, I wanted to bring up something that the Patterson School students brought up that I thought was interesting. And they remembered from the game of Risk that it's almost impossible to ever hold Europe because of Ukraine, and it can be attacked from so many different places because of where it lies on that board game and the number of borders it shares with others. And we see that being played out here. So it matters for all the reasons we've talked about. It matters for international principles. It matters for economics. It matters for politics. It certainly matters for people's lives. And I think back to Dr. Salopian's comment earlier on aviation, it matters now for basic safety and security in Europe. You know, no one expected a passenger plane would ever be shot down due to one of these regional conflicts. And I think people were shocked a bit to find that the solution, once you banned overflight of this region, the next Malaysian Airlines flight actually flew over Syria, which is in the midst of a war. And when that complaint
not a lot of options.
No, and when the complaint was raised, they said the only other options were to fly over Iraq, which is at war, or over Israel, which is at war. We can't afford to have a lot of conflicts like this that threaten global stability in this globalized economic environment that we have.
What is the U.S.'s role in this situation? What should President Obama be doing? What advice is he getting? Is he taking that advice? I mean, what's going to happen there in terms of the U.S. Involvement?
Well, I think he's certainly getting a lot of advice. The problem is it's like a card game. He doesn't have a lot of good cards, and he's not going to be able to get a lot of cards. Military activity here is not helpful. Military activity just feeds conservative forces in Russia that push Putin to be even more aggressive, and I think feed Putin himself to be more aggressive. We can provide some military equipment to Ukraine. John McCain has been calling for that. We can provide some advice and potentially training, but those are long-term things, not short-term things. It really is how do you engage diplomatically? And I think that's something Obama's working on doing, but is also a challenge. We lost our ambassador to Russia. He's back in the United States. We have not yet sent a new ambassador out and got one through the Senate confirmation process. So we don't have a full team on the ground that we would normally like, and that diplomatic lever is probably going to be the most significant one. And what it means is Secretary Kerry is going to have to be more involved in that process.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The U.S. pressure is going to be economic to a certain extent. It's going to be diplomatic as well. The U.S. can afford economically to take a lead on this because our economic relations with the Russians is much less than it is, say, for the Europeans. And this is one of the reasons why the U.S. has been on the forefront of the sanctions issue. It's because the Europeans have been reluctant to impose sanctions because it would have a much more negative effect on their economy. So one of the things that Obama can do and one of the things he has been doing has been trying to wrangle the Europeans into creating a more coordinated response with the Americans. And the EU is meeting today to discuss the imposition of possibly more sanctions on the Russians. So there's going to be that. But it also has to be managed in the context of what Ambassador Kavanaugh said about these other priorities, which are also critical, particularly the situation with Iran. So it's a delicate balancing act.
We have just a few minutes remaining in our program. Natasha Williams, what do you, as a native of that region, wish the U.S. would do?
I wish U.S. takes the more of a position of the diplomatic moderator of the conflict rather than taking sides. And it is a little scary that the United States, you know, in the media creates more of the, one-sided view of the conflict and really in American public does not understand the complexity of what's going on. That's why I think this program is very useful to what needs to be. And it is very important to educate American public to understand that U.S. politicians should not basically run there and wave whether it's flags or dollars or missiles, but what's important is really understanding the complexity and balancing. It's more of a balancing act. And so seeing United States being more removed, and I agree with that, than the other countries involved in Europe gives U.S. this position.
In the minute we have remaining, what should we be looking for, those who are observing the international scene? Should we look for the U.S. in terms of what will give us signs of what's going to happen next?
Well, I think if you see it being pulled more, the crisis, into our domestic political context, it's going to get worse. So we really have to hope we don't see that. And what we hope we do see is greater cooperation on the part of Russia in investigating this and reining in the separatists or rebels or whatever label you want to give them to not have weapons like this. It is just madness, the idea that you would give people who are, you know, maybe okay with a shotgun or a rifle, sophisticated air defense missile systems.
That they can shoot airliners.
That you can shoot airlines out of the sky. That you know, is a responsibility of a state should be, you never do that.
What about internal politics in the U.S.? The issues that Mr. Obama faces in terms of lack of support from much of U.S. Congress?
Well, this is a problem. And really, as Ambassador Kavanaugh said, the more this gets politicized and this gets portrayed as Obama's weakness is really not helpful. It's also not terribly accurate. There's a cost. You just simply cannot involve yourself militarily. You just simply cannot dispense arms to Ukraine without there being consequences to this. And again, as Ambassador Kavanaugh said, he has very few cards to play. So this really should not be seen as a Democratic Republican issue. This has to be seen as a American issue.
Thank you. Professor Ken Slepian, Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh, and Natasha Williams for helping us to understand a little bit more. I hope we've advanced the conversation a bit in understanding the situation in Ukraine. On this week's Eastern Standard, a topic that we hope that we'll be able to stay on top of, and we invite you all to keep us informed about what you know about the situation. And we thank our listeners for listening and hopefully learning from this week's program. We want to thank Jonice Franklin, who's been at the controls, and Julie Tennell has been on the phones. Richard Turner produced this week's episode of Eastern Standard. The program will be online for online listening and download as a podcast at weku.fm, likely within the next hour or two. Thanks for tuning in. I'm John Hingsbergen for WEKU.